he thought I was German for about a year or something like that. Yeah, about a year. And then he was really impressed that I spoke fluent Swedish. And then that's also why he secretly, you know, thinks Bohmian mechanics is a nice theory, right? Because if Bohmians can learn Swedish that fast, you gotta be clever, right? Okay. So this is work in progress. I've just sort of laid out the very foundations of it. And it's yet another attempt to implement scale invariance as a fundamental gauge symmetry in nature. And this is within the context of gravity. So, of course, that has a long history, starting with Weyl in 1918. Other attempts are, for example, Mannheim's conformal gravity. You may have heard other attempts, but so when Einstein came out with his general theory of relativity, Weyl immediately objected, saying that it's very nice, you have eliminated absolute space as a concept in your theory. From epistemology, we know that I can only measure an object's relative position, so I can measure it where it is with respect to everything else in the room, but I cannot measure its absolute position because space doesn't have any distinguishable properties from point to point. And then Weyl said that there's a flaw in general relativity because the same applies to size as well. I cannot measure absolute size or absolute length. If I want to measure length of this table, for example, I need to take a reference object and then see how many times I can lay it along here. And then I say, oh, X, what is this called? Crayons? Crayons? No, of course. X number of chalks fit along this table. But such a measurement is invariant under a rescaling. If this chalk would shrink and the table would shrink, I would be able to fit as many chalks also there. But then you see general relativity, that it actually contains an absolute scale in it. And so Weyl said that just by the same kind of reasoning, you want to eliminate absolute space, you should not try to eliminate absolute size. So the size, the individual length of a table should just be a gauge parameter. And the invariant measurement outcome is the relative length with a chalk and how many times I can lay it alongside the table. Yeah. Well, so that would in fact just be the, so if I have the chalk, well, suppose this is my object now. So that would just be ds, integrating ds here, square root of gij. That would be the length of it. But how do I measure this thing? So in general relativity, between those two points, that sort of marks, you know, two coordinate values, and then I integrate the metric along here, and I get a number, maybe 5. But how do I measure the number 5? In fact, I don't. What I do is I put another reference object here and count how many times I can lay it along there. So in this case, I managed to lay 7 along here.
Yeah, but you said there's an absolute scale. What is the
It's just this thing.
What is the length of that long?
Well, so the absolute length is S,
okay.
And the relative length is what I actually do in the lab. So I have serious anti-gravity here again. Somebody needs to fix this room. So this is a heuristic idea about scale invariance, and heuristics is always shaky. It's actually being recorded. So Weyl's idea, which Einstein called a stroke of genius of first rank, is the example of the first gauge theory we have in physics. So in addition to the metric, g mu nu, so Weyl is also interested in spatiotemporal conformal invariance or scale invariance. So in addition to the metric, we have a four vector potential like this. And Weyl thought this was the electromagnetic field also. And I will come to this later. But for example, the connection in general relativity, so you have rho mu nu, that would be the ordinary connections we have in general relativity, which is the Christoffel symbols. And then it gets modified by this extra. By this extra field like this. This in particular means that we have a non-metrical connection. So this is equal to A rho G mu nu. So this connection here would satisfy this is equal to zero, but because of presence of this thing, you get an extra term. And you can easily realize that the effect of this thing is actually rescaling vectors. So when I parallelly transport a vector, it gets rescaled. So that's sort of the basic idea. I'll come back to a derivation of this from first principles, all these expressions later. So that will become clear why it looks like this and so on. What do I have? Yeah, it's in there too. So one can also realize that if you make a conformal transformation, g mu nu goes into e to the theta g mu nu. And if this guy goes into a rho plus b rho theta, then this is actually conformally invariant. You'll get extra terms here because of this rescaling. So this contains the g mu nu's. But those extra terms would exactly cancel those coming from here. So the connection is conformally invariant, not just covariant, but completely invariant. The connection is the same for all length scales. And that also means that the corresponding, so if you would write down the corresponding curvature, rho sigma mu nu, which is this horrible expression, gamma gamma minus gamma gamma and contractions and so on. Since I'm only taking derivatives of something which is conformally invariant, this is also conformally invariant. So this is not true in general relativity. If I would omit those terms, that would be a complete mess. This thing will have extra factors, extra thetas coming in. And also the sigma nu, the Ricci tensor, that's also conformally invariant. So that's just a contraction. However, the Ricci scalar, that comes with the inverse metric, which transforms as with a what you call a conformal weight minus one. So this object would have conformal weight plus one because there's hidden one in front of there. So we see then that this guy also transformed with a conformal weight minus one. So what Weyl was doing, he wanted to write down an action for this theory now. How would you do that? Well, you like the whole action to be conformally invariant. So you must have a space-time volume element that comes with a conformal weight 4 here, but then you take the square root and you get plus 2 here. And then in order to make this invariant, you need to find something here.
So could a scalar of the vector field? Because, I mean, this A could be gradient of a scalar, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah. So if I do that, So it could be that the only thing I should add is just something like this, yeah. Right?
But let's call it something else because theta is your gas transformation.
Yeah. So I should have phi. That's correct. So if you have it like this, this means that connection is integrable. It's a trivial one, and you can always eliminate it with the conformal transformation. So in fact, if you put this guy here, you get back the general relativity. So this is how you get the sort of the general relativity limit in this theory. And this such a theory with when you artificially put this equal to a gradient of the scalar like that, I'm going to say more why it's artificial later. I mean, this is not a serious invariance of any kind. You can just take general relativity, make conformal transformation, and just collect these terms here, and it will look similar to wild type theory. But that's just you just impose a symmetry by brute force, really just parameterizing the scale. So nothing interesting will come out of that. Well, you just get back general relativity. So, but if this guy is non-integrable, so f mu nu, which is mu a mu minus a mu, if this is non-zero, then you have global effects in this theory. And that's more interesting. So back to this action here. For while, you should just put in something here that makes the whole action conformally invariant, which means conformal weight zero. So there's two things, right? You have to make sure that the terms are conformally covariant, that you don't get nasty extra terms. This is already ensured now, because if you use terms like this, they're invariant. And those terms here are covariant. So for example, here we could put an R-squared term. We could put Rij, Rij. We could put Rk. Sorry, I should have space-time indices. Mu nu, rho sigma, mu. And we can put in F squared term, and also R mu nu, F mu nu. So normally this thing would be a symmetric tensor, but now since we're not dealing with a Christoffel connection anymore, this is not symmetric, and we can contract with an anti-symmetric one and get something out of it. So this is the Weyl theory. So this all looks nice. Of course, we have to fix these things to get a definite theory. Now, there are a series of objections which Einstein raised. When I read a little bit about it, I get the feeling that Einstein was sort of very protective of general relativity. It was a fresh theory, and he didn't like to be eclipsed. I get the feeling like that. But he raised three main objections. The first is that a theory like this will have fourth order field equations. So I have yet to see a proof of that. It might be that this is all right, and that's correct. But so this seems to be the folklore, that problems here. First problem, or first objection. Equations are fourth order, and that generally leads to instability problems and so on. And I think the problem is actually with time derivatives. If you have fourth order time derivatives, that's the real problem. If you have fourth order spatial derivatives, it's not that bad. Because what happens when you have fourth order time derivatives is that the whole initial value problem changes. Instead of giving just configuration and first derivative of configuration, you need to give configuration, first derivative, configuration, second derivative, configuration, and third derivative. So the size of the solution space increases a lot. And you get a lot of solutions which are not Einstein's. So that's generically, that leads generically to problems. Second one is what's called the proper time objection. How do you get something like proper time from this theory? So Einstein made this remark that proper time is given by this integral, integrate and the tau. But the tau square is given by g mu nu, the x nu. And now this is a gauge object because it's a conformal weight 1. And then this means that this is a gauge object. And that means that the proper time tau is a gauge object. So the theory refuses to make unique predictions for proper time if you identify this as a proper time. So Weyl's first, so of course that's bad for a theory. I have a clock here. I can easily see how much it has ticked. And my theory refuses to give me an answer. That's not very promising.
Isn't that exactly why you made the theory though? You just said you didn't want to have an absolute measure of
well,
or length, which I mean, it's the same thing.
Exactly. Let me get back to that for a moment. The first naive response of Weyl was that, well, we should instead consider this as the real proper time. That has conformal weight minus 1 and that has plus 1. So they cancel. And that would be the sort of the tau square tilde. And then, but what if we have a flat spacetime now? So this is 0. We have 0 proper time then? That doesn't make sense. The second response of Weyl was that, well, in order to say anything in this theory, you have to model a real clock within the theory. And Weyl never did that. But now when I'm talking to Lucien, well, he suggested that, well, when I read this, I was sort of bowing to the authorities. So I just assume that this is all very well thought through. But I'm not so sure about that. First of all, I never saw any proof of that, that it's not possible to find the Lagrangian, which makes the field equation second order. Never saw that. Secondly, it seems to be possible to model a proper time within the theory. So my initial response to the proper time, or the light clock hypothesis, will say, no, that won't work. But I think it probably works now if you just work out the details. So the idea here would just be, since this theory have spatiotemporal conformal transformations, and light doesn't feel the difference between conformally related spacetime metrics, you will still have a universal light cone structure in the theory. So conformal transformation doesn't change that. So if I have a trajectory now, and I like to know what the proper time is along the trajectory, I'll take mirrors here around it. And I start down here with some. And then I'm going to count how many times this thing crosses the trajectory. There's an obvious problem with this thing. I need to make sure the mirrors are equidistant. How do I do this here? I cannot use this thing here to define equidistant because it's a gauge object. But Weyl's theory comes with this connection here. This thing comes, I mean, the theory comes with a mathematical machinery of propagating a unit distance along a curve. So this seems, I haven't worked out in details here, but this seems to be an obvious way to do it. So you'd start within unit distance here. You propagate it along, and it's probably the Fermi-Walker propagation I should use here. And you'll find that this, well, so this is my naive or very ideal modeling of a ruler in the theory then. It's a vector, and I should propagate it using this connection, and I should propagate it also with Fermi-Walker, because Fermi-Walker will guarantee that the ruler is always orthogonal to the space-time, tangent to the space-time trajectory. This is just a sketchy thing. I haven't actually worked anything out. According to me, this has to be in the literature because it's such an. I was embarrassed when Lucien said it to me. I should have thought it by myself. So probably this is somewhere in the literature. That somebody actually answered Einstein's objection and worked this thing out. That would be my guess.
But isn't the bigger problem is that this is not Einstein gravity, and we know Einstein gravity works very well.
Well, you have to show. I mean, the devil's in the details, right? So.
Sorry, can you get Poisson equation, solar system, things like that?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but this is Weyl gravity, so.
Okay, so it's a different kind. But I mean, if it's a different kind, then it's a different, has different properties. So,
for example, solar system. one thing, how do you get solar system, the orbits of the planets, for example? Well, usually you take the proper time and maximize it to get the trajectories. Now, before that, there was no unique notion of proper time in the theory. So how would you actually do that? So it seems reasonable that using this notion of proper time, I could define trajectories of planets by maximizing that proper time, which is gauge invariant also in the theory now. So I don't know what people have done here, and I tried to search for it, and it seems to be very little, and much is in German, which I don't read.
Geodesic
image, or not? Well, you have a connection. Yeah, but geodesics.
Way of saying the orbits of planets is that they follow geodesics.
So I haven't thought about any details here. Then that's. So maybe these two are actually different notions. There's the proper time, and there's the geodesic one.
Another comment is that I think, at least if you said F to zero, then I believe every solution of the Einstein theory is this, a solution of this theory, too.
So there's the Mannheim's conformal gravity, when you have the conformal, Weyl conformal tensor squared, basically. And that thing contains all the Einstein solutions. But in addition, this leads to fourth order equations, and it leads to this huge increase of solutions.
Yeah, so you might get that here. Well, I'm not sure I'm remembering that. Maybe someone remembers. But I think that no matter what curvature squared terms you put, the situation is the same.
You always get fourth order.
Well, yeah. I'm not claiming that. You always get a superset of the solutions.
Okay.
Of the Einstein thing. Does someone remember?
Well, you mean without matter?
Or without matter.
Just a lack of.
So. But in any case, this is a pure metrical theory, the Mannheim conformal gravity. Weyl's theory is two objects. It has g mu nu and this vector potential here. So then the third objection is hydrogen spectra. So again, I don't know if there's any serious analysis of it, but the claim is that if you move an hydrogen atom or two hydrogen atoms along different histories, they will have different spectra in the end. And then what I've been gathering here is that, oh, then the theory doesn't make sense because we don't observe it. But of course, you need to do more. You need to show how big is the effect, right? If it's a small effect, then this is a new prediction on the theory and we should look for it.
So that one depends on the rho being electromagnetic potential?
That's also another thing. I mean, Weyl thought this was the electromagnetic one. So according to me, this is a mistake of Weyl. Because if you want to, well, so that's my own objection to Weyl's theory, is that this is the electromagnetic field. First of all, this is not the U1 connection. The Lie group manifold is not a circle. It's the R, because this is, you don't identify a conformal transformation theta and theta plus 2 pi. These are not identified because there's a missing I here. So this is a tiny mathematical difference, but it sort of sets you on the right track of thought, I think. The second one is that when you want to couple this theory to other matter fields, you should try to ensure conformal invariance when you couple it. So this means this connection is going to enter in the derivatives of other matter fields. So it's going to enter universally everywhere. And that you can already guess here, because this field enters in the connection of a theory. It enters at a much, much more fundamental level than the electromagnetic field. So this would probably, you need to work out the details, but that would probably mean that this field would couple to positive charges, negative charges, neutral things, and everything. Except fields which are already conformally invariant, like the electromagnetic field, for example. So I really don't see how this could be the electromagnetic field, unless you throw away conformal invariance when you couple it to matter. But then it seems stupid idea anyway. Thirdly, from cosmology, what we know, the universe is expanding, right? So, but here in this theory, the scale doesn't make any sense. It's just a gauge parameter. So how can you claim that universe is expanding? So I would say the only way you can get away with such a theory is that if this is your galaxies, very nice galaxies, there has to be, this new field has to have the effect of a universal shrinking force, which is pronounced near mass concentrations. So this is the next picture in the series. And you would get the illusion that the distance is increasing everywhere. This is how it has to be in the scale invariant theory, where you have an apparent expansion of the universe. So you know just from if this theory can be made to work, this has to be the explanation for the expansion of the universe. But then it's obvious this is not the electric field, because it doesn't have this universal shrinking effect on everything. It would treat positively charged in a different way from negatively charged particles.
I don't understand what's the difference
between
shrinking galaxies or
expanding. Okay, so here's the galaxies. Right?
Oh, no, I understand. Yeah.
Okay, next thing. Don't ask questions again. So, if you go from this picture to that.
The universe doesn't make sense, why does shrinking something make sense?
No, it's okay, so good. So it's the relative size difference. So if I take a ruler here, this long, and compare it to that thing here, they're one third maybe here. Now I take a ruler like this, and that thing there, and all of a sudden it's one tenth. So. If this AMU can be acting as a shrinking force on things, which is pronounced near mass concentrations, then you would get the illusion of an expanding universe. That something is actually. So this is also the same kind of argument is used by Mannheim. I mean, this is the way you have to explain things, that you get more.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason, many times you just define whether the observables of the theory and then start from there, because otherwise we don't really know what we're talking about. So we should first say these are observables.
Yeah.
And then say that, okay, so then how do they compare to the actual observables? The observations. But as long as we don't define what observables are in the theory.
I should actually get on to what I'm doing. So this is just what I think what has to happen in such a theory. And it's also a heuristical argument. It's a heuristic argument. It's not meant to be precise. So out of these three objections here, I will fix this completely. I'll have second order time derivatives. The theory will only second order. This one, I hope I can fix later by working more. That's dependent on me getting a universal light cone coming out. So I'll be talking more about that.
So you're saying you want a proper time in this theory, or are you just?
So I need to be able to predict what the clock is, how much the clock has ticked. That's absolutely necessary, because that's an observable fact.
I mean, I'm just thinking back. What we were discussing before about how if you have a scale invariant theory,
yeah,
then you need something to set your time scale as well.
Yes. So it can't be this object which is proper time. You need to be able to show what's real proper time in the theory.
Yes, but you do want a proper time. You want.
Even
in the scale invariant.
Well, proper time would here mean that I move a physical clock around space-time trajectory. How much will it have ticked? I need to answer that question. How do I do that within this theory?
But you don't want it to be an absolute number, right? You just need to know the relative ticking between one place and another place, or something like that.
Well, so that's also.
Otherwise, you brought back. I don't understand. Otherwise, you just brought back absolute length. So why bother with the whole exercise?
So I need. I mean
if you build that clock.
Well,
you could build one that runs twice as fast. You could build one that runs.
Sure, but given
it just need some consistency of how it runs along.
Yeah, well. So if I have a definite model of a physical clock, if I have a definite model, it'll tell me something definite, right? So I need to be able to predict that number, which is on the watch.
Once you have the model of the watch, but
no, exactly.
The consistency. I think the consistency is if you have another watch, that all watches should just be multiples of each other.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sure. Yes.
But here in reality, we have an absolute standard. So many
clocks,
times or something like that.
So you
want to do away with it.
So what? This is all, my original heuristics for this thing was that I understand this reasoning with rulers perfectly. Time is a bit different. Maybe we have some. So, but let me just go on because.
So you're going to drastically break.
What?
You're going to drastically break the Lorentz invariance.
Well, that's still to see. So.
But what if you have an absolute measurement of time, you can use that to find an absolute length.
Yes, locally. Yes, you can.
Locally.
Well, and the same thing if I have a ruler, right? I can just use that as a unit, and I can call it 5 meters or 2 meters or whatever I like in this theory.
But that's not absolute.
No, that's just a convention.
Okay, well maybe so. When you say proper time, you're thinking of something absolute in the theory.
Okay.
You don't want an absolute time.
Well, so the argument here is that this is not absolute, therefore this cannot be proper time. That's Einstein's objection, and you need to model the clock within the theory.
Should there be an absolute proper time? That's the question.
What does it exactly? No, I don't.
You said you're trying to overcome this objection.
Well, I think I have to do something similar to this light clock proper time. I mean, in the end, I won't be able to know what the real clock says. That's it.
Once you say that it's a real clock, you mean it is an absolute proper time. And if you just give the idea, you just have relative measurements.
But I mean, this is an absolute. I mean, I don't understand. What is? I mean, a reading on a clock is something which is measurable. This is not an absolute quantity in the same sense of absolute positions or absolute scales. This is an observable quantity in the theory. It's also scale invariant and everything like that. So of course, I need to be able to predict that. And this is what I can do with a light clock model.
You can make a light clock will go twice as fast as your other light clock.
Which is, well,
if you can't do that, then you can reintroduce an absolute time. And by reintroducing that absolute time, if you suppose local Lorentz invariance, then you can use an absolute time.
Well, I don't understand these arguments. So
why don't you just do
that? Yeah, I'm going to do that.
Because the notion of how it's clear and
yeah. So in order to fix this first problem, I'm going to focus on spatial conformal invariance, because then there is this method of Julian Barbour called best matching. It's a way of constructing Lagrangians, and they're guaranteed to be to lead to second order equations in time. So that's sort of the main idea. So we had some discussions here now. This is for future. That's for future also. This one I fix right now. So that's the idea. And as I said before, maybe it's not even necessary to go through this. Maybe what I'm end up doing is actually getting back to one version of Weyl theory, which is actually second order. I don't know, because I haven't seen any proof that you always get fourth order equations. But So here's my implementation now of spatial invariance in the theory. So if I have a ruler here and I have it at one point in space and I move it, that's not a very nice ruler, to a different one, to a different point here, P. If I now ask, how do I make sure that this ruler hasn't changed size? Suppose I just entertain the idea, maybe it changed size. How can I check that? Of course, if I just have the ruler, there's no way I can check that. It's just this ruler. Well, what is its length? I don't know. I cannot measure absolute lengths. So then, of course, I can bring a different ruler along with it and then see if the relative length has changed. But if the shrinking or the resizing is universal, so it acts on all material bodies in exactly the same way, I won't notice anyway. So if there's such a universal sort of gravitational equivalence principle type of field here, acting everything in the same way, I won't locally know with measurements if there's been a real rescaling. So the second argument is that angles are actually different from an epistemological point of view. An angle here, phi, is already a comparison. It's something I can locally measure. I just compare these three units here, and I get the angle. And if I transport such a thing here, I can actually check if the angle has changed as a local measurement. So from an epistemological point of view, rulers and angles are different. That's at least the heuristics. So what do I do now? I would require then the parallel transport of vectors. And I'm going to use spatial indices now because I'm only interested in spatial, or at least for now, in spatial rescalings. So in GR, that thing would be zero when these things are parallel transported. And dvi ds equals zero. But this is too much, because if I put u equals v, I would also say that the length should be preserved.
I don't understand. So you're just talking in three dimensions now?
Yeah, this is, so now I want to implement, in order to fix this, I know how to fix this if I implement first just three-dimensional scaling
in
advance.
So is GRK changing with time or not?
No time now. This is just a static picture. I'm just having a curved space. I'm parallel transporting things. So in GR, or in, if I would require that length do not change, this thing has to be zero if I parallel transport these vectors. Because if u equals v, that's just the length of it. But what I should require is this, that's zero. So if you work this out, you get to this conclusion that Gij and Uiv that this has to be zero. Because this has to also apply for all different trajectories. So I need to make sure this is always zero. And that will tell me that, the only way that could happen is if this is equal to AK GIJ. So the relation I wrote down before in Weyl's theory, but now for space instead of space-time, just follows from this reasoning here that there's a difference between sizes or lengths and angles. So I should require this to be preserved and not that, because that's too strong. And when I do that, I realize there's this new field in the theory. So
so you've just re-derived. You've just gone through what I went through.
Yes.
Implicitly.
Yes.
But in three dimensions.
Yes. So I had to reconstruct it. Probably Weyl is doing the same thing. But I don't read German, so So I couldn't. So.
So in what language is chalk mean press?
Correct.
What language was that?
Okay. So I'm running out of time a little bit. So if this guy goes into GIJ like this, then we find out that this guy, AK, must go AK plus DK theta. So this follows from that relation. And you can also solve for the connection, and you get that connection over there. And you can repeat the same arguments here with conformally covariant things and so on. So let me go on to quickly go through best matching.
Sorry, Hans, you restrict yourself to only conform invariants in three dimensions.
Yes.
But GR in three dimensions, the vowel tends to zero. So I'm just trying to understand how much actually done over what you would just have. If you break, you know, if you break between space and time, you say that the spatial sections are special somehow. And even in GR, the vowel tends to zero. So.
Yes, but I'm not going to make use of the vowel tensor here.
There is a tensor that.
There's a Coffin tensor. Yeah.
What's it called? Coffin?
It's a Coffin tensor. But that's what figures in Horava gravity also, the Coffin tensor. But this is completely independent of that. So.
And you're not going to write down the GR action. You're going to write down the.
Yes. I'm going to follow a different. So look here. What I did here was just. Well, the problem for Weyl was finding an action which is a scalar density and it has conformal weight zero. That's the name of the game there. What I have to do is very different now. I have to follow a different strategy because I'm focusing on configurations, spatial configurations. So how do I get a reasonable action? And such a strategy or method exists, and that's what's called best matching. So this is developed by Julian Barber and company. So so let me just sketch quickly. So maybe I have to jump over some material. So best matching, what is that? All best matched actions are square root actions. They're actually distances on configuration space. All dynamical solutions of the theory are the ones that minimizes that distance. So you have a distance, which is an integral, and then comes a square root, and there's the kinetic term, and this basically has that form. So that's a very short introduction. This kinetic term, for example, if I take, so the kinetic term plays the role of measuring change. So the basic problem I have for particle mechanics, so I have x1, x2, a set of points, is that how do I get a reasonable measure of change when I have this gauge orbits in the theory. If this gauge orbit here would be, for example, a translation of the whole universe or a rotation of the whole universe, I would like to say that from this point to that point, that's the same change as going from that point to that point. So it's the problem of defining a change in the theory. And I don't want that change to be dependent on what gauge I'm choosing. Where the universe sort of is, which is not observable anyway. So the basic idea behind best matching is to define this gauge invariant length. And the idea is that you take the ordinary mass weighted distance. So here you would have the you would take this mass weighted distance. So this is, of course, something which would depend on if I move the whole universe. But instead, I allow for infinitesimal translation now. And then I find the translation which minimizes this one. So it's sort of like if my trajectory goes here to here, then I find the one which is minimizing this thing. So I'm minimizing the change. So that's why it's called best matching also. You can visualize this. If I have particles here at one moment of time and particles at the next moment of time, what is the difference now? In Newtonian theory, I would have absolute space. So even if they're exactly on top of each other, that would be a huge difference. But according to best matching, I'm allowed to use a translation to sort of find the one which minimizes the square mass-weighted distance here. And then I'm repeating the same thing with rotations also, and also dilations or scale transformations. So this is where these auxiliary fields comes in. So from this point of moment, it's very easy to implement this sort of relational symmetries. I could put in translations. That's a sort of bold T. I can have an infinitesimal rotation if I like, and I can have an infinitesimal scale transformation, and I square this, and I vary with respect to that, and then I get out the best matched distance, and that's the thing I'm going to put in this T here. So that's the real measure of change.
So these transformations are dependent from time?
Yes, so these things are allowed to be time dependent, or in here you... Yes. So for example, the Barba-Batoti theory, or S. Barba-Batoti, that has an action which is square root, and then comes KMK, XK dot minus T minus R cross K minus dxk squared, and then there's a potential, maybe an energy term, something like this. And there's also the case that if you have scale invariance here, this E has actually to be equal to zero, because otherwise, yeah. But there's more things to say. But I just want to get the general structure of it across. This is how best match actions looks like. And it's motivated by this kind of epistemological considerations. Once you've seen this, you realize that we have it elsewhere in physics. You have Maxwell theory, for example. The action Maxwell, and that's equal to d3x. And you have a dot minus phi squared minus and you sort of say, oh, this is the best matching structure, right? I have a change like this here, and I have an infinitesimal gauge transformation. And there's the best, I can also write it as a square root, if I like. So the best matched version, let me call it the best matched electromagnetism, that would have a square root. The kinetic term is just this thing, dot minus del phi square d3x. And then there would be an energy and d3x and del cross a square. That gives you exactly the same predictions as Maxwell's theory. Then you go to general relativity, and it also has a best match structure. So if you take the ADM action, if you write that out, it actually looks like this. This is called the Willi-DeWitt supermetric, Gij dot. And what comes here is exactly an infinitesimal 3 diffeomorphism. And you repeat that with indices KL. And what comes here is the potential and some energy. So the energy equivalent here is actually the cosmological constant. What's different here is that, and this is what's interesting, it has a local square root structure. So the square root comes here, and the integration over x comes outside. So notice the difference here. That has a global square root structure. The integration is taken after I've computed the integration here and the integration there. But in GR, it somehow this is reversed integration. So this will be actually explained, this feature, more or less by what I'm going to do. It's basically going to be enforced this local square root structure. So this is just to give a short introduction to the best strategy of constructing Lagrangians. So now we'll construct the theory, and that will be very quick now. So there's important points here. This peculiar local square root structure that's after the integration or inside the integration, this is the thing that gives rise to 4D homomorphism in the theory. So although you've started with three-dimensional geometries and only implemented 3D homomorphisms in the theory as a gauge symmetry, you surprisingly end up with 4D homomorphisms in the end and a universal light cone structure. So this is what's surprising here. And I'm counting on the same unexpected thing to happen with the theory I'm going to write down. But that's not checked yet. So what will I do here? I'll have a kinetic term for gravity. I have two fields now. I have G and I have the A field, right? So I need two kinetic terms. So let me first write down this term. Now I can just choose what the symmetries I should implement here. Well, I like 3D homomorphisms, and I like a scale transformation. So that's the infinitesimal version of it. And then I should take the same thing, but K and L there. Now I need to square, I need to get a quadratic term also, because I want to have this mean square best matched difference, right? Oh, sorry. Okay, I'll write it down. This is just the same thing here repeated, but with the only natural thing I can put here is the Willebrand superspace metric. There's nothing else I can put here.
So why is that? I mean, we could have any combination of metrics. That's not unique. That is
diffeomorphism
invariance that fixes that.
Yes, 3D diffeomorphism invariance.
No, 4D diffeomorphism.
It's actually 3D diffeomorphism invariance.
So there are three combinations of Gij, and so you can have Gij, DKL, and Gik, GJL.
And then the
relative ratio of those terms in that supermetric, that's arbitrary.
But there's a reason why you choose this one and not another one. And that's the implement.
Well, so the one that is in GR, this is the actual, the Wheeler supermetric, that's the one that gives you the homomorphism invariant.
But I
think. The 4D homomorphism, right? This lambda parameter in which I'll Lipschitz theory, so that's.
Well, I think the requirement is the following that if this is. Let's see how much time I have. If this is the space of three metrics, I have these gauge orbits now. And if this is the same metric now, but just difference in the 3D homomorphism, and that's the same metric here, then I'd like the distance to be the same everywhere. So we shouldn't depend on the three-dimensional gauge orbit. And that, I haven't checked this myself, but this is what I think leads to this thing. But let's leave that as an open issue. Then I have this kinetic term. And the only thing I can put here is basically Gij, the only natural thing here. So in order to have conformal covariance, this needs to go into that thing. When I'm making the conformal transformation, Gij goes into e to the theta Gij, and Ak goes into Ak plus dk theta. And of course, this is just one of these auxiliary fields I'm using in order to best match. These are not considered physical fields in the theory. So if this has this transformation rule, everything is conformally covariant. This has then conformal weight plus one. This is plus one. This one is basically the inverse of the metric squared, so it has minus two. So I would see that this whole term has zero. It's conformally invariant. So that's a nice term. However, this term here, that is conformal weight zero, zero. This is minus one. So that thing has minus one here. So in order to get total kinetic term, I need to resolve this thing. So somehow I should add these two terms. So let me now write down the 3D Weyl action. There should be a square root. So this is the only natural thing I can think about. You multiply that with R. That is minus, where is this now?
TA or TG?
TG. TA. Yes, sorry, it should be TA here. So then this gets, I might have been confused, yeah. So let me just think. That has conformal weight zero, and this. No. Yeah. Confused. So TG has zero weight, but now it has weight minus one with this thing here, and then I add the TA term, which is conformal weight minus one. So this I can add, and it would have a. This would be a conformally covariant combination. TA.
What is
a small I?
This is just a constant because I can put whatever I like there. So, and then I have to fill stuff here. And I know that I have to have a volume element here. The volume element comes with 3/2 as a conformal weight. So I know that inside here, it has to be minus 3 in conformal weight, because then with the square root, it's minus 3/2. So I need to put in the potential now here. And that's going to be basically the same terms. Well, it's going to be the same terms as Weyl could put in here. It could be an F squared term. It could be an R squared term. It could be an Rij, and so on, all these terms here. What I wrote down before, where I have them. So those were the terms up here. But now they're spatial ones. So this is basically the action of the theory. I'm hoping that term will only be there, but I'm not sure.
Supposing you have a cosmological constant?
There's actually not much room for that here. Suppose I'm adding plus lambda here. Well, that would break the conformal invariance, because that has conformal weight zero, and these guys have minus two. So there's really no room for it in this theory. So that's another thing I need to get back. And probably it's gonna, if this is working, the cosmological constant would be space-time dependent, probably, if there's something like this in this theory. And if there's not at all, then the theory is wrong.
Of course, more importantly, you need to get TR out.
Yes. Yes.
Let's see, TJ, TG had conformal width 0.
Yes.
So why can't you just add lambda to it, replace it by itself plus lambda?
You mean like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, in fact. You're right. It's a nice contribution. Yeah, you can add something there. So that would be very different than, I didn't think of this, so that would be very different than the usual, which would really come in as an addition to the Ricci scalar, right?
Yeah,
so it's weird. But yes, you. Yes, so maybe you call it Q or something else.
It also doesn't have class matching.
What? Yeah. So it doesn't have a best matching structure really. So this is the most natural thing I can write down. Yeah. But I agree, I mean there's the possibility of adding a constant there. And then already here, of course, we're fudging a little bit with what's called best matching because we have to multiply midway with an R, right? So why couldn't we just add something? So let me end now very quickly with the Hamiltonian formulation. So that will be the end of this talk. You'll have canonical momenta. And you know, you want me to write them down or no? So let me just summarize. So you'll have canonical momenta like this, and pi I dl dA I dot, and then you also have the canonical momenta with respect to phi. Which is dl d phi dot, which is identically 0 because there's no phi dot in the action. And it's the same thing with the lapse here, k dl d nk dot. And that's also identically equal to 0 because there's no n dot. And then in order to get these primary constraints to propagate, so now I'm going to sort of turn the Dirac constraint analysis handle here. In order to get those to propagate, that is taking the dot of those things, which I can use the Lagrangian equations of motion to calculate the dot of that thing. If I require that thing to propagate to be 0, then I get this constraint, pi ij, gij, minus nabla I pi I equals 0. So this is a secondary constraint. And here this looks like Gauss' law a little bit. Here you have the electric field, which is canonically conjugate to AI. And the divergence of that has to be equal to the charge. So this is also the extrinsic curvature, basically, the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And that acts as a charge for this guy. And if you require this thing, k, to be equal to 0, then you end up with the usual component of the momentum constraint, but also an extra term because of the presence of this AK field. And those of you who have just skimmed a little bit in Ashtekar variables recognize this term. This is the terms you get there also. So this is expected that you would have one term because of Gij like that, and another term because you have a one-form field basically. So this is how the momentum constraint looks like. Then by making combinations, there's another primary constraint which is the Hamiltonian constraint. If I make the following combination, I find that this combination A, G, R, and the potential. So I'm just going to call that thing in here the potential now. It could be F squared or whatever. That's also identically equal to zero. So that's a primary constraint in the theory. So this looks like, this is sufficiently different from the ordinary Hamiltonian constraint, which would look like this, and some square root of g here also. But now you really get different terms here. So to end the seminar now, so in the end, I need to get something like a universal Lyapunov structure, at least approximately. But my guess is that I have to get it exactly also. So mathematically, this means that constraints need to propagate. So this is my Hamiltonian constraint. And the propagation of this, well, you have to take a time derivative of this thing here. And it's an absolute nightmare to do the calculation. So I'm just getting started, basically. And just to get started, it takes a week. What happens for Julian, which is details in his paper, relativity without relativity, is that you start with 3 diffeomorphism invariant. You implement that with best matching. And you put in this local square root, which is really put in without reason there. But then you see that with the special form of the potential, namely the potential in GR, R, and possibly the cosmological constant there, you get the Hamiltonian constraint to propagate, and the universal light cone pops out. Also here, let me just, I forgot to comment about this before. Round off, yeah. So it'll just be 1 more minute, so maybe 2. I don't see how I really can. If I write down something natural, I have to have a local square root if I want, because I need the kinetic term for each space point to be cancelled, the conformal weight of that to be cancelled by something. So it seems that the only natural structure here is when I have spatial scale invariant, is to have a local square root, because for each space point I need this thing, the conformal weight of that thing to be, well, everything should cancel for each space point. And that seems to enforce a local square root. So that I find interesting. Maybe there's an explanation of why you have this structure. In GR, that's a mystery in the best matching. You just put it there, you get the Hamiltonian constraint, and it propagates, you get the universal light cone, and everybody's happy. Here, there might be an explanation for that. If I put it inside there, you will. Yes.
So if you just wanted locality, just wanted local field equations, that would already be an argument for putting the.
That seems sound. So I looked a little bit. Is this his questions? Part now the talk. Yes. What was your question now?
Another rationale for putting the square root inside the integral and outside the integral.
So if you
would
put
be just locality itself.
Yeah, if you put n equals 1 there,
which
in that gauge, you will.
You would like to put the integral on the inside.
Yeah. At the outset, because they'd like a non-locality. So if they want this to be quantum mechanics as well.
I looked a bit like that, and that it, with a certain time gauge, with a certain gauge choice of n, you can make that non-locality disappear. So it's not. That's my recollection of it.
So it's
a choice of gauge, synchronous gauge. Well, so in this theory, there is no gauge choice, anything like that. In fact, I can already guess if this constraint propagates and I get foliation invariance and a universal light cone, I already know what the spacetime metric should be. What I put here, well, it has to be Gij. What do I put up here? It has to be the lowered shift vectors. What I put here, well, it should be the n, right, and this thing. But what is n now? So the standard guess is just that term there. So I think if I'm going to get this Hamiltonian constraint to propagate and get a foliation invariance, I'm going to be able to write down a spacetime metric. But then I'm confused with the folklore claim, or maybe it's proven somewhere, that you necessarily have to have fourth order equations. Because then I would have a spacetime theory with second order time derivatives. So it could mean that since somebody has proven that, I mean, there are always.
But you don't have four diffeomorphism invariants here.
How do you know? If I get the Hamiltonian constraint to propagate, I'll get it.
Why is that? Can you say why is that? Okay, that if you get the Hamiltonian constraint, you said two things. You said that if it propagates, you'll get four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants, and you get a universal light cone structure. Can you say a little more why that is? I think it's the reverse. I don't think it's guaranteed. If it's propagated, that doesn't mean you have 40.
Well, why is it reverse? Okay.
But
why reverse you? That's interesting.
Here's the case, right? If I get so now I'm naively assuming that if I get the Hamiltonian constraint to propagate, that means I have foliation invariants. So if I have a spacetime like this, and I do this identification here, I can foliate it no matter how I do it. And that should be four diffeomorphism invariants.
In the usual theory, the Hamiltonian constraint, if you believe the usual point of view anyway, pushes the hypersurface forward by locally independent amounts.
Yes.
And so by doing that, you can turn any foliation into any foliation.
Yes.
But here you have an absolute time, so is it not pushing it forward rigidly?
No,
why is it pushing it forward?
Okay. If you take this.
Is your analog of the lapse? The freely choosable lapse?
So what happens? Okay. So what happens in the. So I didn't write this down. So there's the. What I do here now? There should be zero. So there's an action called the Beilein-Schwab-Wheeler action, which is equivalent to the ADM action, and that looks like this.
Okay.
That theory is four diffeomorphism invariant. The lapse, so this is T here, that's the kinetic term, and that's the potential here, V. The lapse is equal to square root of T over V in that theory. And you have the shift there. So the spacetime metric you would have is this n squared plus nk, nk, nj, ni, gij. That's your spacetime metric. So, I mean, you start with something which is looks like it has an absolute time in it, or preferred simultaneity. But because of this local square root structure, you end up getting a Hamiltonian constraint to propagate, which by then you can push forward this hypersurface faster here than there, and you get this.
Why can you push it faster in different places?
What?
Where is the freedom that allows you to push the hypersurface forward by different amounts in different places?
In this theory?
Yeah.
Well, so in fact, if you take this theory, you get exactly the same Hamiltonian as in ADM. So
when you say propagate, do you mean?
So
you smear it with an arbitrary lapse function.
Yeah,
exactly.
So I would take Gij, for example, and when I compute its time derivative, Gij, that would be the Poisson bracket, and the total Hamiltonian here, the total Hamiltonian is equal to the spatial integration lapse h plus shift hk, and these are the momentum constraints now. Right. This thing leads exactly to that Hamiltonian, and this constraint propagates also. If you have, I mean, if you put different terms here, like r square, for example, it doesn't propagate. If you put the, that's basically it I can say here.
Lucky that you can embed this into four space time, because you happen to have this Lagrange multiplier, you can identify with G00.
Yes.
And you have another shift that you can identify with G0i.
Yes.
But it's not clear that if you make the same identifications, this is going to have the space time.
Yes.
If it is, then you have foliation invariance probably.
Yes.
So I think that's the statement that if you.
It should be embeddable, yeah.
Constraints close and it's embeddable, but I don't have conditions. I don't have conditions for embeddable.
Well, this is Hanno entitled. Is it Hanno or? He wrote his PhD thesis on exactly that. So if you just have. There's some very general. But the constraint structure of the constraints comes very generally from just embeddability. So. But there's some kind of a mystery here that I haven't seen the proof yet that this has to be four, that any spatiotemporal, well, Weyl theory has to be fourth order. But suppose that's true, then if I get universal light cone structure and if I get embeddability here, wouldn't that be a counterexample? No, that's what confuses me here. It could mean also. When they prove what they write about this,
you will get four-dimensional conformal invariance then.
Yes, that so
does
so.
That follow too.
That if I do this identification of the lapse in this theory, that has the right conformal weight also. This would have minus one, plus one, plus one. Everything would just have plus one here, so it would be. The right identification. This is why I'm guessing this form also. Now, of course, this had naturally the ones upstairs, and they have conformal weight zero when they have upstairs, but then you need to lower them to get into the GMU here, and then I get plus one conformal weight. So this seems to be, if there's a space-time metric hidden in here, probably has to be this one, with the lapse identified in this way.
Why don't we adjourn and let everyone who wants to
continue
asking questions.
Sure.
Let's thank you.